Chapter 10. Things to do in Denver when you're doomed. Awkward small talk over stale coffee. It's not how Johnny imagined catching up with his former associate, but Patrick is badly shaken and somewhat withdrawn. Johnny is short on time and urgently needs to draw him out, so coffee in an almost deserted Starbucks with a sullen, overweight barista pushing a mop around the floor is the order of the day.
How long have you been in Denver?
He asks.
4 years.
Patrick's hand shakes as he tips a paper twist of sugar into his espresso.
More or less.
Not long after he left the network, then.
And on their retainer?
About the same.
Patrick falls silent for a moment as he concentrates on stirring his coffee with the ritual focus of a heroin addict cooking up the next hit. Not spilling a drop demands infinite patience.
They're bastards. But they look after you as long as you're useful.
What do they want you to report on?
What you'd expect.
Patrick half shudders, half shrugs.
We're up the highway from Colorado Springs. The Holy Rollers are big in Colorado. Mostly they're harmless, long as you're not a young woman in search of an abortion.
And sometimes?
Patrick grimaces.
If there's talk of miracles, wine out of water, speaking in tongues, they ask me to check out a service. It's a bad job, I can tell you, but usually it's boring. When it isn't...
He pauses long enough to pick up his cup with shaking hand.
I'm not there.
Ever checked out an outfit called the Golden Promise Ministries, out of Colorado Springs, run by a guy called Schiller?
Patrick shakes his head.
Doesn't ring any bells.
Johnny keeps his thoughts to himself. Instead, he pulls out his wallet and, after a quick scan, counts out bills.
Here's 500. The number on this card is a burner. Call me if you see anything that might interest your, employers. Call me when you've got a repair bill for the car, and I'll pay the garage for you.
Patrick stares at the pile of 50s. He reaches out and shakily pushes them back across the table.
Not playing that game, Johnny. I'll thank you for fixing my car, but you don't know what they're like. What they do to double agents.
It's Johnny's turn to stare. Then, after a few seconds, he shoves the money back towards Patrick.
Then it's my penance for spoiling your evening, mate. Call me when you've got the bill for the car.
Patrick stares at him, perplexed.
You can't fix everything that's broke with money, Sarge.
I know, but money helps.
Johnny knows exactly what's going through Patrick's mind.
What's happened to my old Sarge, then?
He stands. He doesn't want to have to stay and explain.
At least I tried.
He walks out the door, moderately certain that this is the last time he'll ever see Patrick. It's cold, and a solitary snowflake spirals down in front of his face. He goes to his truck, climbs in, and starts the engine.
Maybe I should tell the Duchess, he ponders.
But there's no telling where he'll catch her. Best get it sorted himself. He drives away slowly, with a head full of darkness and questions. It is perhaps inevitable that his encounter with Patrick distracts him and leaves him in a disturbed state of mind. Old ghosts swirl around just beyond the corners of his vision as he drives back towards the third safe house, less attentive than usual. But as he parks opposite, a pricking in the skin of his chest brings him sharply back to a state of alertness. Something, his sixth sense, is telling him is wrong. It's too late to drive on, but, as usual, he hasn't parked directly outside the front door. Johnny stares at the safe house. The warning is worryingly nonspecific. The vague itching and sense of dread tells him nothing useful. He slides out of the cab, keeping the truck between himself and the safe house windows. He leaves the door ajar as he rapidly scans the sidewalk, then breaks into a jog. The itch fades as he leaves the shadow of the pickup, just another local out for an evening run. It's amazing what people will miss if they're not watching carefully, and he didn't pick this neighborhood to sight a safe house on the basis of its vibrant street life. Once out of the direct line of sight from the safe house, he crosses the street, re-scans to make sure there are no bystanders, then doubles back. His nostrils flare as he ducks and glides around the side of the house. There is a kitchen door that opens onto the backyard, and it has a well-oiled lock. The key turns silently.
Johnny steals inside like a thief in the night, right hand drawn back and knife in hand. It's of a single piece, the blade oddly flat, the handle an extruded extension, a thing of power, lethal as a cobra. A gift from the Duchess years ago. The kitchen is dark and still, and just as he left it. The tripwire, actually an empty tumbler set on the floor just inside the door, still present, but his skin is prickling again. If there was an enemy already in the house, it would be far more intense. What if they aren't here yet? Johnny stands up, then passes through the ground floor rooms silently and rapidly, ending just inside the front door. The pizza joint flyer he'd balanced against the front door when he left is still upright. No, not here yet. Which means... There is a bright discordant jangle of shattering glass from the front window on the lounge, to the left of the vestibule he's standing in. Johnny turns, lowering his knife to a gunfight, he absently realizes, as a familiar rattling hiss kicks in. Gas grenade. He smiles, lips peeling back from teeth in a frightening grimace. Johnny's got his fight. Persephone used to have nightmares when she was a girl. Dreams that would drag her shuddering awake, drenched in a clammy sweat, with her own shriek of terror echoing in her ears. They always started the same way, with her waking in a hospital ward, moonlit through unshuttered windows, surrounded by the living dead. They were living because they breathed in their sleep, lying cold and motionless on beds with rusting steel frames, sheets drawn up to their chins to cover the wounds and evulsions inflicted upon their bodies by the metal of war. But they were dead, too, because they would never wake. She could force herself out of bed inside these lucid dreams and poke and pry at the sleepers, scream her lungs out into their cold blue ears to no avail. There were always 20 beds on the ward, 19 of them occupied by sleepers, male and female, young and old, white-skinned and sallow in the moonlight. She could run to the end of the ward, or fly at will, and there was a corridor, and on the other side of the corridor another ward, another 20 beds. Up and down the corridor the ward stretched towards a morbid vanishing point in the gloom. She'd ventured into the corridor once or twice, but the first few wards she checked were all the same. And besides, she wasn't alone. She never actually saw the Watcher, but she knew it was there, a lurking imminence observing her increasingly frantic explorations, avoiding contact for the time being, as, suffused with a growing sense of panicky terror, she cast about for relief from the infinite loneliness of the graveyard. Curiously, it never occurred to her to gaze out through the windows at the night world her dream had crash-landed in the midst of. Years later, in her early teens, she'd shyly confessed these dreams to her adoptive father. It was a tentative gesture of intimacy as she began to deconstruct the emotional barriers that she had erected during her childhood in the camps and on the long road out of Srebrenica. Alberto had taken it seriously, not poo-pooing it as teenage angst. Rather, he sat her down and delivered the first of a series of lectures on the interpretation of dreams, with the aid of a copy of the Liber de Mortuus Somnium.
"Precognitive dreams are not representations of a fixed future," he explained. "Rather, they're echoes of events which hold particular resonance, sufficient to overcome the barrier between now and then. They might not come true, and they are in any event symbolic, not literal predictions, but you should always take them seriously."
Then he spent an afternoon with her, showing her how to make a dream catcher from cobwebs and feathers, and then how to program it as a screensaver on her Amiga. And she'd taught herself to sleep soundly without waking the rest of the household. She never learned to like hospitals, though. Now the night world has crashed through the window and landed in the ward of the dead in the mid-afternoon light, and it's Persephone's turn to be the watcher floating through the corridors, observing and monitoring with a cold knot of horror. The open window is one of three at the end of a hospital ward bay. There are four beds on the bay. Two are occupied. It's very quiet, but for the heartbeat beeping of monitors tracking pulse and ventilation rate. One of the inmates is sleeping, but the other woman follows Persephone's progress with frightened eyes. Persephone tugs her skirt down,
hitches her handbag strap up on her shoulder, reaches for a convenient lie, and offers a smile that doesn't reach the corners of her eyes.
Don't worry, I'm just taking a look around. Journalist.
She walks towards the door at the end of the bay, then pauses as two slivers of fact slice through her mind. There's a door on a ward side bay. You don't put doors between a patient and the nursing station if there's any risk of acute incidents. Doors are for privacy, and a woman's eyes are still watching Persephone, but her head... She turns and walks back to the woman, who lies utterly still on the bed, breathing but unmoving except for her eyes.
Can you speak?
She asks quietly. The woman, girl almost, late teens, early twenties, blinks at her with horrified eyes, then begins to silently weep. Her lips move as if in prayer, but her body lies still as if stunned, bedridden, paralyzed. Persephone notices the sealed port of a nasogastric feeding tube nestling by one nostril. No wonder she can't talk. This is a long-term spinal injuries unit. Persephone pulls her camera phone out of her shoulder bag and captures the layout of the bay on a slow video scan. She spots the file by the head of the bed, medical notes. She has a queasy feeling. Something here is very wrong.
You don't mind?
She asks, taking the file. The woman's eyes close. There's a name on the cover. Marianne Murphy, 23, saved. Persephone's brows furrow as she pages through the notes, reading and photographing the evidence. Yes, nasogastric feeding. Yes, physiotherapy. But oddly, no medication. Nothing about vertebrae or spinal damage. Then Persephone comes to the ultrasound scan printouts. Images of a fetus, results of amniocentesis. Her skin crawls. She points her camera phone at the woman.
Blink if you understand me.
Marianne blinks, and now, Persephone realizes, the young woman has a name to her.
One blink for no, two for yes.
Blink, blink.
Are you held here against your will?
Blink, blink.
You're pregnant, aren't you? Did they make you pregnant?
Blink, blink.
You're paralyzed. Was there an accident?
Blink.
Was it the ministry? They did this to you?
Blink, blink. The nightmare is solidifying around her. Persephone glances at the sleeper in the other bed, sees a nasogastric tube and a cervical collar to lock the woman's head in place. She can see what's happening here, although she's reluctant to acknowledge it. In the combined spinal injuries and maternity ward, the women are prisoners in their own flesh, arrow factories for the full quivers of the theocratic movement.
In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. Is that what he said?
Blink, blink. Persephone swallows. Very gently, she reaches out and touches Marianne's forehead.
Can't stay. Got a story to tell. I'll put an end to this, I promise.
Blink, blink. The creches and kindergartens of a quiverful movement, pious mothers raising bountiful families of young believers for the greater glory, 10 and 20 children, far more children than most women can bear, need additional ammunition. So they look further afield, to the wombs of young unbelievers taken by the roadside, homeless runaways, addicts, prostitutes. Doubtless they've got a little list of those who won't be missed. Bait the line, spread the net, carry them down to a quiet hell filled with hospital beds, where they'll be paralyzed and used like wasp-stung caterpillars to nurture their kidnapper's spawn. She can hear Schiller's apologetics echo in her mind's ear.
Nature is bountiful. Nature gives us great examples of God's meticulous design for life, including certain parasitic insects.
Persephone removes her finger, suppressing a shudder, suppressing thought, forcing her body into obedient calmness. She'd like to scream with rage, smash things, forget the job and rescue these women right now. It's a fatal temptation, but it would be a mistake. In fact, if she leaves behind any sign that she's been in this bay, she will be signing their death warrants. Schiller will not suffer such witnesses to live and testify against him in federal court, so she will be heartless and patient, for now. There is a clipboard by the other woman's bed. She takes it and holds it to her chest. No spare stethoscopes or white coats, unfortunately. The clipboard will have to do. It's a Saturday, so the place should be running on weekend staff. 15 minutes have passed since she broke from Schiller's bid to brainwash his new recruits. The alarm will be out. Escape is going to be difficult. It's becoming clear that there is a lot more to this operation than just a rogue church. She closes her eyes for a moment, composing herself and wiping the expression of feral loathing from her face. Then she opens the door and starts to search for an escape route. The hospital, as it turns out, is running on a weekend shift pattern. The wards are almost deserted, except for the hunched, unmoving forms of the inmates. There are no televisions, she notes, but a number of bedside lecterns feature Bibles that are open at particularly educational passages, displayed before the captured eyes of the bedridden. One of the Bibles sits beside an empty bed. Acting on impulse, she takes it, tucks it beneath the elbow of the arm with which she carries the clipboard. As she nears the end of the ground floor ward, she approaches a nursing station. Two nurses, both women in green scrubs, are discussing something. Persephone's breath catches, and she makes a peculiar gesture with the fingers of her left hand. Sounds flatten and footsteps fade away as she approaches the desk. Neither of them seem to notice her. It is Persephone's privilege and her burden to shorten her life's extent in return for the grant of certain powers prearranged. It's not unlike smoking.
Bed in Bay 6, one of them is saying, and there's a prep kit in Ward 2 up back. Eileen will be able to show you.
When's this new arrival due?
Asks the other.
Not sure. He said there's been some problem. Patient tried to run. Doesn't want to comply.
Oh dear.
There's something wrong with their voices, Persephone notices, with the heightened perception that comes with her occult bargain. She should have noticed it before, the slightly mangled syllables of the believers.
It's the hosts, she realizes, with a frisson of revulsion.
Well, you go and get the prep kit. I'll make sure the bed's ready when they capture her.
The taller nurse nods, then walks right past Persephone, unseen, in the direction of the lobby. Persephone spins a blind spot in the remaining nurse's mind and hides within, holding her rage in check. She barely allows herself to breathe until they are alone in the room. Then she lets the shadows slip from her shoulders.
Hello, she says, smiling. I don't suppose you'd let me borrow your car?
The nurse stares, mouth opening to shout, as Persephone brings the Bible around sharply, spine first, against the side of the woman's head, then drops it and grapples. It's not much of a fight. The nurse has no idea about self-defense, and Persephone has her face down in a chokehold within seconds, closing her carotid arteries until she stops struggling. Persephone finds it takes a serious effort of will to relax her grip. She wants someone to pay for what's happening here so badly she can taste it. There is an office off to one side of the reception area, into which Persephone drags her victim. As she begins to shake and snore, coming round, Persephone leans over her and again invokes one of her stored macros. An hour of life against a couple of days of deep unconsciousness and subsequent memory problems. A fair bargain under the circumstances. A couple of minutes later, a woman in hospital scrubs steps out, carrying a shoulder bag. Nobody pays her any attention as she walks out to the two-story car park on the other side of the road from the maternity hospital. Cameras and robot imaging systems might notice, but Schiller's people distrust what they see through a glass darkly, and human eyes have difficulty noticing Persephone when she is willing to pay the price of moving unseen. Neither does anybody pay any attention to the nurse who can't remember where she parked, walking up and down the rows of vehicles, clicking her key fob remote, until finally a Toyota pickup clunks and flashes its lights in welcome. Persephone climbs in, dumps her handbag on the passenger seat, and starts the engine. She doesn't bother with the seatbelt, but on impulse checks the glove box. There's a box of ammunition and an odd-looking revolver within, a Chiappa Rhino Snubnose. Expensive and exotic for a nurse, but gunliness is clearly next to godliness for these folks. With a humorless grin, she tucks her spoils into her handbag beside the Bible. Then, without any fuss or amateur dramatics, she drives away from her mission, the church compound, and the ward full of nightmares. Denver is a middling old city by American standards. Founded in the mid-19th century, it's almost as old as the post office at the corner of my street. Most of it is trackless suburban sprawl, residential streets with no pavements for pedestrians, alternating with uninhabited retail and industrial zones, consisting of air-conditioned and mostly windowless boxes. It is, in short, uninhabitable without a car, except for a small chunk of downtown and the central business district. So my first job is to procure a set of wheels. There's a Hertz rental agency in the basement of a hotel a couple of blocks away, according to my Jesus phone. So I walk over, shouldering my bag. "What have you got right now?" I ask the woman at the desk.
Let me see.
I can't tell if it's an accent or a speech impediment. She rattles away on a keyboard, pounding at a mainframe user interface that probably predates the dinosaurs. Then she frowns.
"We're out of compacts and SUVs. Will a coupe do?"
"A what?" I blink, then shrug. "How much?"
"The basic package is $340 a day."
I shudder quietly, hand over the magic card, and hastily make some notes on my phone. I'm being robbed blind, of course. The basic package doesn't include insurance, fuel, or sat-nav. By the time it's loaded up for a week, with an option on early drop-off at the airport, I'm looking at the thick end of a return business class fare to Christchurch via Ulaanbaatar.
"Sign here."
I just hope Lockhart's going to approve this. The car itself proves to be a coupe, rhymes with its typical owner's toupee. A land barge with a detachable plastic roof like an aging sales manager's hairpiece. It bears the same relationship to a sports car that a round of golf bears to a half marathon. I sling my bag, complete with sleeping horror, in the boot, plug my phone into the cigarette lighter, and fire up the anti-tracing app from Offcut. It won't stop a chopper or a coordinated four-car tail team from following me, but it'll work against casual remote viewing. Then I hit the road. After wrestling my way out of the car park, hopefully without leaving too many paint scrapes on the concrete pillars, I drive for miles beneath sullen clouds that weep a thin drizzle of sleet. The skyscrapers slowly give way to big box stores, drive-ins, streets of cookie-cutter houses, then finally scrub, separating anonymous industrial units. More miles, and I come to a highway with signage for the airport. Apparently, it used to be a strategic bomber base, a flat pancake of snow-capped concrete stretching for kilometres in every direction. I stick the car in a short-stay car park and head into the terminal, looking for the British Airways desk. It's the regular cattle market of check-in areas and retail concessions, leavened by more public art and shopping than usual for an American airport. There are a lot of delays flashing on the departure board, probably the better to cause the punters to part with their money, and the concourse is heaving with bewildered-looking travellers. I must have hit rush hour or something. It takes me a while to get oriented and home in on the desk. "Good evening," I start, then lay what I hope is a winning hand on the counter. My return open biz class booking, a passport with a diplomatic visa, and the Coutts card. "I've been called back to London at short notice. What can you do for me?" The clerk on the other side of the counter is clearly perturbed.
"Would you mind waiting here for a minute, sir? I'd like to fetch my manager."
Oops, not good. Any one of those cards should be sufficient to trigger a bowing and scraping reflex. I nod, and while her back's turned, I pull out my wallet and palm my fourth and final card, just in case. The skin on the back of my neck is itching. Every time an airport cop walks past, I have to forcibly suppress the urge to stare. A few seconds later, she's back, with an older BA staff member in tow. This one wearing the kind of uniform suit that says management.
"Excuse me, sir,"
she says, assertive with a side order of London accent that's barely been here long enough to go native.
"I'm told you need to rebook a ticket."
I smile at her without showing my teeth.
"Not exactly."
Open passport, display visa.
"Head office want me home on the next available flight. I was hoping to rebook my ticket."
Tap finger on full-fat business class booking confirmation.
"Or failing that, perhaps you could arrange something?
via corporate?
Wave platinum card. Her eyes are tracking my fingers, but her expression is saying something else.
I'm really sorry, sir,
she says, looking as if she means it.
I'd love to sort you out, and normally it wouldn't be a problem, but all departures are grounded as of an hour ago.
What? I can't help myself.
It's the incoming weather system. There's a huge storm coming down from Canada, and it's threatening to drop 20 or 30 inches of snow on us overnight. As if that isn't enough, there's a tornado warning out. It's a weather bomb. They're still landing inbound flights, but nothing's going out before tomorrow at the earliest. And between you and me, I reckon the airport will be closed until early afternoon, if not all day, if that ice storm is as bad as they're saying.
I show my teeth, but keep my warrant card back.
Are you sure? Is it possible to charter a bizjet? Just to one of the main hubs, I mean, not all the way to Heathrow.
She's shaking her head.
I'm sorry, sir, but nothing's moving. They're even grounding the traffic news helicopters. It'll be the rescue and air ambulance services next. Never seen anything like it. If you want, I can... Let's see, I can bump you to first-class standby on the next available flight, and if you leave your cell number with me, I can...
I shake my head. Don't worry, I say. I'll drive out. And I gather up my papers and leave before she can get started on arguing me out of the idea, because I'm afraid she might be right. Driving through an apocalyptic ice storm in a convertible isn't the smartest thing I've ever done. However, I do not get a chance to maroon myself in the Rockies in the middle of a blizzard. It's not for want of trying, but as I drive out of the airport, the snow is beginning to fall. I turn on the windscreen wipers and headlights and turn east, out along the interstate. Traffic is surprisingly light in both directions. Then, after about 5 miles, the traffic begins to thicken up, and I see flashing lights ahead. A couple of highway patrol cars are drawn up across the road, light bars strobing, and the cops are out with illuminated batons, waving cars over to one side for an inspection. No, it's an off-ramp. I slow, going where I'm directed. They don't wave me over, but keep pointing around the curve of the cloverleaf. More cops. Another diversion. I realize what's going on just before I hit the next cloverleaf. There's nobody behind me, so I slow and wind down my window. The cop with the light waves at me, then points on in the direction of the on-ramp back onto the highway in the direction of Denver. What's happening? I call. Just another guy in a suit driving a mid-range coupe, not a target.
Road's closed, he yells. Get moving!
I have no desire to stop and argue with the Colorado Highway Patrol, so I just nod and keep rolling. The air outside my bubble of rental luxury is frigid. I roll up the window and accelerate back up to highway speed, thinking furiously. Once upon a time, an intelligence officer said,
"Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action."
I'm not an idiot. I can see the pattern here. First, I was doorstepped by the opposition. Then I was ordered to scram. Meanwhile, all flights out of Denver are grounded by an anomalous ice storm, and the cops are closing the roads out of town. Is Schiller really that powerful? The evidence suggests he might be. Lockhart says he has the FBI and local cops in his pocket, and I'm having bad dreams about the sleeper. Maybe that last one is a coincidence, but if I were a betting man, I'd put money on the other stuff being pieces of a really unpleasant jigsaw. I've seen anomalous bad weather before, triggered by a greater invocation. Oh. Oh, shit. I do so very badly hope I'm wrong about this. It's late afternoon. The shadows are drawing in. Persephone drives away from the back roads of Pike National Forest without looking in the rearview mirror. Her knuckles are white on the steering wheel. She doesn't untense them until she hits US 85 and sees the long chain-link fence and open spaces of the Air Force Academy unwinding to her left. She's badly rattled, angry and shaken. It's an unpleasant sensation, familiar from her half-forgotten childhood, and one she has carefully structured her life to suppress. "I fucked up," she realizes coldly. Schiller's people are on the ball, and if she hadn't cut and run, she'd be in that chapel even now, gulping down the choking wine like blood, as the host holds unholy communion with her brain. It's anybody's guess whether Johnny is still free.
She's torn between the urge to contact him immediately and warn him, and the fear that she'll catch him in the middle of a ruck and spoil his aim. Either way, it'll have to wait until she's far enough from her pursuers to stop for a few minutes. She forces her emotions back under control as she drives, performing the comforting rituals of scan and evasion with eyes wide open for any hint of pursuit. The sky is grey, almost yellowing, promising bad weather. As the miles unroll behind her, her pulse slows to normal and her grip relaxes slightly. She chews over the day's events, trying to make sense of them. The church compound and the clinic in the hills, the ghastly combined spinal injuries and maternity ward, the rite of holy communion with unholy parasites, born again in control of their victims' nervous systems. They're all parts of a vile jigsaw puzzle, but she has a distinct sense that she's missing something. What are they trying to achieve? She asks aloud. What does Ray think he's doing? Normally she'd be asking these questions of Johnny. She punches the hub of the steering wheel lightly. What did he say?
Why aren't we saving them?
Schiller clearly believes his own spiel, and he's a man with a mission, literally as much as figuratively. Let's assume he's serious, she murmurs to herself. He believes his God is coming back to ring down the curtain on the day of judgment imminently. He knows he's saved, but most people are going straight to hell. And let's also suppose that he isn't just a sociopath milking a money machine. He's making all that money because he's got something to spend it on. He's going to want to... Her eyes widen. Save everybody, by any means necessary. She glances sideways by long force of habit, taking in the passenger seat, empty but for an open handbag holding a book and a gun. Traffic is thickening ahead. For a while she focuses on the brake lights. The exit for Fort Carson comes into view. Nearly there. During a slow patch, she pulls out the book, lays it in her lap, and steals glances at it as she pushes her way into the right-hand lane, eyes scanning for exit 141. The clouds are darkening, and occasional snowflakes are hitting her windscreen. The book is a Bible, of course. Leather cover, gilt trim, heavily thumbed, with numerous bookmarks poking out like angry porcupine spines near the back cover. Revelation. Figures. The exit sign slides into view, and she takes the exit ramp as fast as she can, then turns north to lose herself in the dusty, tree-lined suburbs of Colorado Springs. There is a quiet residential street, fronted by trees that separate tidily maintained houses at 100-meter intervals. A relatively small church with a stone-clad steeple anchors one end of the stretch. Persephone drives past it a short distance, then parks. Swallowing bitterness at the back of her throat, she lifts her left leg and rips the blister plaster from the back of her ankle to reveal a temporary tattoo. Come in, Johnny. There's an acrid choking stink at the back of her throat, garlic mixed with stale vomit. Persephone gags, feeling muscles spasming, legs pumping.
Not now, Duchess. Got my hands full.
Shit.
She drops the link into his head. Eyes streaming with the burning itch of an allergic reaction.
Tear gas?
She thumps the steering wheel, angry at her inability to help him. Johnny is up to his eyeballs. The man from the laundry is bugging out, not without good reason, she admits, and the Golden Promise Ministries is something far worse than they had any reason to suspect back in London. Neither a money machine nor a mere front for occult cultists. It's shaping up to be an enormous clusterfuck. If she had any common sense, she'd follow Mr. Howard's advice, collect Johnny, and get out of town. But she can't shed that childhood nightmare. Can't forget the young woman's eyes tracking her from the bed, trapped in a prison of her own flesh. Sticking plaster, nail file, a transient pain. To her, immediately suppressed surprise, she's seeing through Howard's eyes. Clearly, he isn't terribly experienced at this mode of communication. He's driving through falling snow on an interstate in a prison of her own flesh. Sticking plaster, nail file, a transient pain. To her, immediately suppressed surprise, she's seeing through Howard's eyes. Clearly, he isn't terribly experienced at this mode of communication. He's driving through falling snow on an interstate. She has a sense of confusion and building worry, even anxiety. A road sign looms out of the murky twilight. Denver. He's driving back towards Denver? That doesn't make any sense. Hello again. He's noticed her. Noticed her and let her think he hadn't. Watch yourself, Persephone reminds herself. Got problems. Johnny's in trouble. That's not the only problem. Howard's anxiety is infectious. The airport's closed by this damn storm, and the highway patrol have blocked Interstate 76. They're diverting all traffic back into town. I'm going to try Interstate 70 to Kansas City, but I've got a bad feeling about this. What storm? There's a really scary weather system coming down from the north. It blew up overnight without any warning. They're talking about most of a meter of snow in the next 24 hours or so. Can you spell Fimbulwinter?
Can't be. You're completely cut off?
I won't know until I've tried the other routes, but I think so. What's your situation?
I'm parked up in Colorado Springs. It's not snowing here yet. Johnny's in trouble, and I think at least one of our safe houses has been burned.
She bites her tongue, about to raise a delicate topic, but Howard beats her to the punch. Tell me where you are, and I'll come and pick you up. Then we can go find Johnny and get the hell out of here together.
Agreed,
she sends, squashing her instant burst of relief. Then she settles down to wait and opens the Bible to the first of the bookmarked pages.